there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 270. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is, of course, This Show Is So Gay. And go to the Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. So much ground to cover on this week's episode. We must introduce our guest. Sharon Staple is the executive director of the Anti-Violence Project, an organization that empowers lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, and HIV-affected communities and allies to end all forms of violence through organizing and education. And the Anti-Violence Project supports survivors through counseling and advocacy. She's one of my favorite people on this planet. She is making her fifth appearance on This Show Is So Gay. Sharon, welcome back to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you so much for having me.
It has been well over a year.
It has been.
One could argue an eventful year for us both.
I think that might be an understatement.
Okay. And we're going to get to all that, but we got so much to talk about with violence, and last night I did what I assume you do every single night. I read the 2013 report on lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, and HIV affected hate violence. I assume you know that report.
I am familiar with it,
yes. Okay. So I was reading through it, and I do want to talk about some of my emotional reactions to it, and especially because this is your fifth time on the show. So I want to talk about progress in some areas, and then after reading the report, I feel like maybe not so much progress in other areas. Mm-hmm. But there were some very specific pieces of the report that I pulled out that I don't think that we've discussed in great detail, and so I wanted to put some information out there and have you fill in some blanks for us. You ready?
Okay.
From the report, I read, overall, 45% of survivors reported their incidents to the police, which is a decrease from 56% in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't seem good.
No. Well, you know, it depends. I think it might be good for people who, if they had reported to the police, would have experienced more violence or, you know, as we sometimes call it, re-victimization by the police, right?
Right.
But as a general trend, if we accept the idea that the police are meant to be helpful to people who experience violence, then it's a trend we do not want to see continue, for sure.
When you see a decrease from 56% to 45%, what are your initial reactions in seeing that? I mean, it's obviously not necessarily the direction we want to go.
No, you know, but it actually made a whole lot of sense to me.
Okay.
In terms of if you look at the year that we've had, right? And if you look at the national profile that law enforcement has had, and, you know, if we start just with Trayvon Martin, right?
Right.
And we start with you know, the sort of law enforcement response or the criminal legal system's response to that. Or if you look at stop and frisk sort of movements across the country. And in New York City, AVP was very involved with the local stop and frisk initiative and campaign. But for years, the NAACP has been working on these issues. And, it, you know, you sort of saw over the last year the issue of people being profiled, harassed, stopped, frisked by the police become a national conversation, right?
Yeah.
And the more we talk about the ways in which law enforcement might abuse their power, you know, the more I think we're giving people information that is helpful for them in knowing what might happen if they're engaging with law enforcement. But I think also the more careful people become in thinking about the police as a resource as opposed to thinking about the police as a potential barrier to
right.
getting the support that they need. And I think that this is not new news for lots of marginalized communities who have experienced this kind of harassment with police forever,
yeah.
right? I mean, when we talk about communities of color, we talk about queer communities, we talk about trans communities, we talk about those communities that at the intersections, like we're talking about the experiences that people have had for a long time. But I think when you start to see the national conversation about this get a little bit more traction, you start to see folks that might not have the day-to-day experience with police harassment start to think, wait, maybe this isn't a safe place for me to report violence, right?
And maybe if we can, for each of these points, I would love to connect it up to what the Anti-Violent Project is actually doing to address these issues, because I want people to start connecting. You know, I went back and I listened to your past four appearances on the show. I normally just do that when I wake up in the morning, but in particular...
So at night you read the report, in the morning you listen to our shows. I feel like we're really bonded, Ken.
Listen, yes, restraining order right on the cusp. That's okay. That's okay. It's the type of work that you do. I was listening, and we talk a lot of theory, and I think that you and I can live in that space too, but you and I also do on-the-ground work, and you in particular doing on-the-ground work. And I think sometimes our listeners are just in having these conversations with other folks, they're totally signed on to the theoretical of like, yeah, that sounds bad, we should address that. But then when we get to that step of, okay, but what do we do?
Mm-hmm.
People feel overwhelmed, or just there's that disconnect. So
I absolutely agree.
So with the police, what have you all been working on?
So there's a couple of different things that we've done, the first two campaigns that I'm going to talk about are things that I think people can readily get involved with, both in New York City and if it's happening in their communities. And so the first one was the stop and frisk work that we did. And we started doing this work with the NAACP back in, 2010, 2011 maybe, and it sort of culminated in the Father's Day Silent March. But for us, that was just sort of the beginning of the work that we were doing in New York City to raise awareness. And we started working with a group called Communities United for Police Reform that has largely been leading the charge to get the police to be more accountable to the communities that they are policing. And so in that space, what we were able to do is bring the voices of LGBT people to the forefront, and really working with community members that we were talking about their experiences with the police, and doing things like letter writing campaigns that I think people are familiar with, or, you know, nowadays it's all social media, right? So it's all, you know, sort of reposting and retweeting things, but also having folks speak at press conferences, having folks speak to elected officials or to community members or other community-based organizations about why we all need to sort of come together. And I think for folks who are interested in this type of work, that really what they're looking for is their local organization that is organizing around police violence or police misconduct, or even just police community relations and how that's happening. And in New York, AVP is one of the entry points, and there are actually quite a number of organizations that are a part of that coalition. But the other campaign that we worked on that we're continuing to work on, because we were largely successful with the stop and frisk as a part of this larger coalition. The city council passed legislation to prohibit certain behaviors with the NYPD, right? But the other campaign that we're still in the process of is in New York State, when you're carrying condoms and the police stop you, if they find condoms on you, they can use that as evidence that you are engaged in a prostitution-related offense. Right?
Wait, what? That's a thing?
I know. This is insanity, right? And every time I talk to people about it, I literally become speechless in trying to explain the logic, because there is no logic to it, right? So there's no language to talk about the logic. But there is this theory that, with illogical, in my opinion, theory, that condoms are evidence of intent to engage in prostitution. Now, that's, again, it's illogical to me.
I know this is radio, so it doesn't make for a good image, but my jaw is on the table right now. I mean, I can understand, I think that that's the law in colonial Williamsburg, but I don't, in New York?
Well, and part of the reason it's illogical is because, and so now I say this from a lawyer perspective, right? Like, the presence of condoms on your person is evidence of the fact that you are carrying a condom, like nothing else. Like, there is nothing else you can draw from that, but that you have a condom on you. So from a legal perspective, it just baffles me, right? But then also from a public health and public policy perspective, it is absolutely contrary to all of the resources, and we're talking millions of dollars that New York City and New York State are putting behind distributing condoms to lower the HIV infection rate, right? So it's just this absolute cognitive dissonance between what one state agency or one city agency is doing and what another state or city agency is doing. And so we have a multi-pronged strategy, and there's state legislation that's been introduced that we're supporting, and really getting folks to get behind in terms of educating their local representatives and making it clear that this is a priority and making it clear that this is something that they want their legislator to act on. And then we're also working with law enforcement to try and convince them to change this voluntarily. And then also, you know, working with community members to make sure that their voices and their experiences and the impact that this kind of policy has, not just on, say, a criminal record, but also on their willingness to carry condoms and use condoms and engage in safer sex, like that real chilling effect that is happening. And I think there the entry points for people who want to get involved in this campaign or any other type of campaign that you know, is of interest or is relevant to people's lives is, you know, understanding the impact that they could have on local officials. I think sometimes people think it's kind of useless to contact their local official, right? And doing this kind of policy work, both on a federal level and on a local and state level, I can't tell you how many politicians have told me, like, oh, I got 15 phone calls about this, so it must be really important, right? And it's like, what if you got 1,000 phone calls?
Right.
And so I don't think people understand the power of their phone call or the power of their email. Like, if politicians hear from a critical mass of people, and apparently some people define that as 15 or more, like, and that's a very small number of people. Like, you can actually get that kind of organizing done really quickly and really easily and figure out a script and ask 15 of your closest friends to call and say, this is important to me and I hope you vote this way and I want you to support this issue. You can actually affect change at a legislative level, right?
I don't even, after the whole condom story, I don't even want to do this show anymore. I'm like, people are going to ask in the future, hey, when did this show Is So Gay stop? Oh, well, Sharon Staple told the stop and frisk condom story, and he jumped the shark, and that was pretty much it. I'm in awe. And I'm a pretty knowledgeable guy. We're moving on to another area. So, folks, call your legislators and tell them about this condom thing, because it's crazy. Unbelievable. Is that the case in other states?
I don't, you know, I'm so focused on New York right now that I'm not sure, how prevalent this is across the country.
All right.
I know, you know, and so I'm going to give you one more example that is not about the illogical condoms evidence stuff. Because this is actually happening in lots of other states in this really exciting way. One of the things that we had a real problem with, especially around police harassment and violence, is the way in which police officers treated transgender and gender nonconforming people.
Right.
And we have a local law that says you have to treat people respectfully and equally. It actually had some examples about how to do that. I mean, it was a really comprehensive law. And yet and still, we were getting so many complaints from people who were being treated disrespectfully by the NYPD.
Yeah.
And so in that case, and this is a higher sort of level of advocacy. This isn't necessarily advocacy that you can do on your own. It really does have to be connected to community-based organizations, I think. But, you know, we started talking to the police commissioner about what was happening. And finally, after, you know, many, many, many more months than it should have taken, but we finally got the okay to talk to their legal department, and we sat in a room, there were a group of us, for almost, I think, 2 years, and went through the patrol guideline that tells cops on the streets what they're supposed to do, and sort of like literally just, you know, corrected or amended or added language that we thought would be instructive to police officers on the street in the ways that they can talk to, and they must talk to, respectfully, trans and gender nonconforming people. And again, that's a higher level of sort of advocacy. It requires a little bit more leverage and a little bit more power, which is typically found in community-based organizations. But I think a well-organized group of people could probably make enough noise to get that kind of thing done as well. And there, what you're really doing is starting to shift the organizational culture or the institutional culture, right? And,
yeah.
And, you know, they get trained on it. There's an expectation. There's a penalty if they don't pay attention to it. It's a really effective way It is mind-numbingly boring at times, and it's a lot of minutiae, but it's a really effective way to shift culture when it comes to trying to deal with institutions that have some degree of willingness to change, you know?
All right.
So there's the practical stuff.
Well, I like the practical stuff. All right, more from the report.
Okay.
Almost 90% of all homicide victims in 2013 were people of color.
Mm-hmm. And this is a multi-year trend.
Yeah.
I mean, the 90% is as high as we've gotten, but it is a multi-year trend that the vast majority of homicide victims of people are people of color.
And further, about three-quarters of homicide victims were transgender women, and more than two-thirds of homicide victims were transgender women of color.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think what we're seeing there is the intersection of racism, homophobia, transphobia, and really the intersection of racism and transphobia,
yeah.
Right? And the ways in which when you get right down to it, when you talk about that kind of oppression, and that kind of oppression gets operationalized, it gets operationalized in some form of violence, right? And so whether it's spoken violence or policy violence or physical violence, right? And I think what we're seeing here is, and again, both of these statistics, both about the impact of homicides on people of color and communities of color and on transgender and gender nonconforming people, and then specifically on transgender women of color, those are multi-year trends. So this is something we've seen for the past 3 years, right?
Right.
I think what we're seeing is both the increased attention to and increased reporting of this type of violence. I think these trends have been happening for far more than 3 years, right? But we're starting to see media being more accurate in the reporting of who is being killed and why. We're seeing law enforcement being a little bit more accurate in their assessment of the motivation for these crimes. But we're also seeing friends and family members being more willing to engage in support and resources. So we're getting more reports about this violence. But we're seeing this is what operationalized oppression looks like. It looks like killing people, right? And
in my mind,
in the way that I sort of try and deal with this, which is it's such overwhelmingly terrifying information, right?
Right.
I really think it's an epidemic. Like, I think that this is, like, in June of 2014, we saw 5 trans women of color who were killed in June, right? That is such a startling, terrifying number. And this data, this aggregate data, backs up that this is a trend that's happening. And to me, it means that we actually have to be doing the kind of organizing work that we're doing, that we just talked about around, you know, police harassment and police violence. We need to be working with and in communities of color. We need to be working with trans and gender nonconforming communities, and we need to be working with trans women of color to be able to both identify and talk about how folks experience this in their lives along the spectrum of violence that they experience, right? But also, like, what are we going to do to really bring attention to this? And I think, you know, we've been doing a lot of work at AVP for 4 or 5 years now to really make sure that we're reaching particularly trans women of color and you know, developing relationships and developing trust and really trying to figure out how do we lift up those voices and how do we really get those policy priorities that trans women of color have identified or the actions that they want to take that they've identified. How do we get that to the forefront of the discussion that we're having both locally and nationally?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you look at an artifact, I'm all about looking at visual representations of what's going on. If you go to your homepage, if you go to avp.org and you just look at the homepage and you look at what's new, 1, 2, 3, 4 different press releases that all start with the same group of words. The National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs mourns the death of. Four different ones, and it's just,
exactly.
I mean, any one can be overwhelming, but I want to just write a story that says the National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs celebrates, just to throw in there, but it's just not
exactly
what's going on right now.
Exactly. It really is not what's going on. And in this way that is always so counterintuitive to the work that we do, where an increase in reports of violence is often a success story for us, right? Like the more people who are reporting,
right,
the more people that know about us and are using our resources,
right,
and all of that. There is no success to this story, right? Like people have lost their lives, and it's sort of just tragic and preventable and so horrifyingly unnecessary for people to act out their transphobia and their, you know, racism in this way. But the thing that I think keeps us sort of focused on how do we end this is the fact that we are starting to identify these patterns in a way that allows for folks who aren't necessarily connected to trans people, aren't necessarily thinking about violence in communities of color or that trans women experience, that it really allows people to see, like, wow, this is a really big issue, and this should be my issue too, right? Like, if
right.
I care about the queer community, I have to care about people of color. I have to care about trans people,
right,
because those are the folks in my community that are at the most risk of violence. And so I think there is a real opportunity here amongst, you know, all of these tragic losses in these different communities.
Right. And that caring has to happen not just post some big murder that's being covered,
exactly,
in the news. You know, we had two pretty prominent murders of our trans sisters here in Cleveland back in December, and the whole community came together, not really sure, you know, what direction we went in. I think everyone just felt really overwhelmed. But right this second, you don't hear anything about that at all.
Right.
So
right.
So there's work to do,
right,
there.
Exactly. And I think, you know, again, this is a, you know, in the sort of real life, I feel like this is going to be the episode you listen to all the time.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
We talk about real life stuff, right? But one of the things that we do at AVP is we've put together these community action committees where when we're doing outreach, we say to people, you know, this is what's happening in your neighborhood, and these are the resources that are available, and AVP is here for you. And by the way, have a condom, but don't get arrested with it. But have a condom and other safer sex material because we want you to be safe. And here are all the ways you can get involved in AVP. And one of those ways is come to our community action committee meetings and tell us about what you're seeing in your neighborhoods, in your life, in your world, and work with other people who are telling us about what's happening in their lives and in their world to, you know, collectively sort of harness that action. And really what we're seeing come out of our community action committees, which deal with different types, we have different three different committees that deal with three different issues, but what we're seeing is that folks really are understanding the urgency to act on the issue of especially trans women of color in New York City right now is a really important issue. And this is without having necessarily a headline that just happened,
right,
in the Times or,
right,
in the Daily News. And it's real, you know, it is on the ground. It is often, you know, strategic and thoughtful and planning, and then there's the big action that you go out and do. But a lot of the work that goes on behind the scenes happens on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis. And these committees are a way to give people the structure to do that, right?
Yeah.
And I suspect that if there are anti-violence programs or LGBT organizations in the areas that your listeners are in, that they'll have something similar, some entry point where community members can get involved in the real work that they're doing in a way that is both, you know, it's an opportunity to meet people, it's an opportunity to learn stuff, but it's also an opportunity to bring your expertise, your voice to this conversation and to move issues from, you know, this is an epidemic and we need to do something about it, to these are the specific actions we're going to take to be able to, you know, to start to try and reduce this kind of violence.
And you can't sit around and wait for other people to swoop in. I know that when this community responded here in Cleveland, they held some sort of, it was kind of a rally, it was maybe a vigil, it was possibly a meeting, no one really knew what it was, and which are very different things. And there were,
yes,
there were national figures here, and many of them we've had on the show before. You know, Kyler Broadus was there, and Mara Kiesling.
I love Kyler.
Kyler's great, and Mara Kiesling was there, and she was fantastic, and someone from GLAAD was there who looked a little deer in the headlights, and everybody was great. But we didn't necessarily need national presence there in that moment. We needed people from the community to step up and say, you know what, we really know this community, and ours is the voice that can really create change in a different way than someone swooping in, which wasn't what I think the national folks were like, we're not really sure why we're here either.
Right, right. And I think, you know, I think that there can be, there is this, like, opportunity to bring together these expert folks who work on these issues every day, and they do these big policy things, and they're inspiring, and it can really galvanize people, right? But I think at the end of the day, if you don't also have a concerted grassroots action on the ground in local communities that are talking about the issues that are most important to local folks, then you're not actually going to be effective, because the national folks can only represent what's going on the ground. And if there's nothing going on the ground, they don't have anything to work with. And frankly, a lot of the solutions are necessarily local, right? Yeah. And so national experts, as phenomenal as they are and as smart as they are and as much experience as they have, they're not necessarily going to be the right key for that particular lock. Like, you really need the local folks to be doing it.
Let's do one more stat from the report, because we have not talked about this at all in your past appearances on the show. Undocumented survivors were 3.5 times more likely to experience physical violence. I don't think that makes it onto the agenda very much at all that I hear.
No, absolutely. And you know what's interesting about this is this data is actually a result of multiple years of a concerted effort by NCAVP to both reach more undocumented immigrants and to get more information from undocumented immigrants, right? So there's this sort of combination of both outreach and trust building, right? And especially if, you know, I mean, if you are a member of a marginalized community and someone is approaching you and asking you to give them, like, very personal information, there's a very low likelihood that you're going to do that, right?
Right.
There's not, you know, there's a sort of what's in it for me, or what are the potential, like, more importantly, like, what are the potential problems that I'm going to, you know, encounter. And I think here we understood for many, many years, like, this is about trust building within the communities. And part of the power of NCAVP is that we are, you know, 49 organizations throughout the country, and we are working on a local level. So when we're building trust with folks, we're building trust with folks in our communities, right? Because that can take a really long time to do. And so one of the first things that we wanted to do is really reach more undocumented immigrants and be able to ask questions about their experiences that we could then represent in the report. And that takes a while. This is the first report where we've really been able to have the kind of data as a result of those efforts that is helpful in the aggregate to really explain these circumstances. So I'm not surprised by the numbers. Like, I'm not surprised by the data because, it makes sense. Like, the most marginalized people are going to experience the greatest severity of violence. And here, when you're talking about undocumented people, there are so many potential dangers in reaching out for support or reaching out for help. And forget about calling the police, right? Because the police are you know, a part of a system that is intended to deport you, right? And even in places like New York City, where there's a very clear understanding that the police will want to encourage undocumented survivors of violence to come forward,
right?
And there aren't any repercussions. That's a hard thing to trust, right? But when we're building trust from a community-based organization level, I think that's a little bit easier. So we have this data now. It is, again, it's not surprising to me, because it follows that sort of theory of oppression, right? People who experience the most oppression are going to experience the most violence as well. And undocumented immigrants in this country are, I mean, once again, this is a topic that makes me speechless, right? Because we are just so inhumane in the way that we talk about immigration policies in this country, right? But I think also the benefit to having this data is that it allows us to advocate on behalf of undocumented immigrants in the aggregate anonymously without having to have any one individual come forward, but about the real experiences that they have and the impact that that violence has on them. And I think that can help us start to think about, okay, what does immigration reform look like? What does immigration, you know, initiatives or campaign, what do those look like?
Right. oh my God, I'm like thinking, what if you're undocumented and you're in New York and you have a condom on you? That yeah. like that could be
and
terrible.
And you're a trans woman of color, right?
Right.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah. No.
Right.
I mean, it's and honestly, Ken, like those are that we've done so much work to really build relationships with undocumented trans women of color in New York City because of the absolute disproportionate impact of violence that they experience,
right.
and the resources that we think we can bring. But this is an unfortunate, very common story, right?
Yeah.
It's a very common experience in the lives of trans, you know, undocumented trans women of color. So,
well, the full report is right there on AVP.org. I urge people to go check it out. Maybe not your bedtime reading, but certainly something that you should check out because you have to know these facts in order to have a conversation on it. And one of the things that the report brings up for me, and in your fifth appearance now on our show, I feel that, you know, I can push you a little bit. And let me preface what I'm about to say. I'm not trying to get you in trouble. I don't want to damage any of your relationships, but I actually have some questions and one question for you about AVP's relationship with the other national LGBT organizations. Because
mm-hmm.
as I look at their web pages and as I look at some of their work, there seems to be a big disconnect between mm-hmm. what it is that you all are doing, and let's even be more simple, what it is that you all are reporting and what's showing up on their feeds. If I
mm-hmm.
look at the human, and we have to like, I want to talk specifically about this because we have these national organizations, and I have often argued they don't necessarily always work together. But when I look at what you all are doing and when I look at the other ones, I really do see a disconnect. And it's
mm-hmm.
not for me to paint you all as, you know, like the AVP is the Debbie Downers of the organizations. And, you know, the other one. I'm not saying that, but if you go to even and let's leave the homepages behind. If you go to Human Rights Campaign and you even click on their hate crimes tab, even in their news section, they're not reporting half of what you all are reporting. They make mention of the fact that hundreds gather together to mourn the transgender woman in Fort Myers. Nothing about anything more recent, much less on their homepage. And so
mm-hmm.
when I look at your site and I talk to you and then I look at their sites and I talk to them, it feels like there's a disconnect. Is that fair to put out there?
I mean, I don't know if I would describe it as a disconnect. I think it's quite possible it is a disconnect. I think that there are different roles that
right.
people or that organizations play in this movement, right? And assuming there is such a thing as a movement, which I think is an open question, right?
Right. Oh, that's fair, yeah.
So I think, you know, AVP is a local organization. Like, we're in New York City, we do some New York State work. But our national coalition is a national organization, and we actually work quite closely with these other national organizations around, you know, our role. And our role is to bring forth the sort of aggregate information that we have about the way that violence is experienced by queer people, HIV-affected people in this country, right? Like, that's the information that we have. But we are a different type of national organization because we are a sort of we are literally a coalition of community-based organizations on the ground throughout
right.
the country, right? So we have access to different kinds of information, but we also have a different mission or a different sort of priority about doing this. We see our job as bringing attention to the very specific incidents of violence that LGBT and HIV-affected people experience in this country, and working with other national groups who, frankly, if you're working with LGBT people, you are probably dealing with violence on some level, right?
Right.
But for other folks, they have, you know, they have a different role. Like, they're interested, for a long time it was, and it still continues to be, but, you know, it was marriage, or it, you know, it's ENDA, although that's, you know, we'll see what that
yeah.
is all about as this progresses, right? But it isn't necessarily I think that all of the national organizations that we work with, they're definitely committed to anti-violence work, but we have the expertise and the
right.
data on that violence, right? And I think that is our sole lens. Like, our lens is to talk about what safety means to people, and to talk about what safety means to people means to talk about the violence that they experience. You know, I also think that we are much more willing to go public with something hasn't been confirmed to be anti-LGBT, right? So if you look at, you talked about the four posts on our website about the trans women of color who have been killed in the last month. In those reports, we say, you know, there hasn't, in many of them, like, there has not been a conclusion that this is anti-LGBT. Like, this is something that we're really concerned about, or this is, you know, there has not been a formal conclusion that this was transphobic motivated violence, right? And we're really, really comfortable going out on that limb because we think that we have a really good idea that it probably was,
right?
Because it often is. But also, it's our job to bring attention to these issues, right? Organizations like HRC, like, they may want to wait until something is confirmed by law enforcement,
right,
before they step out on that, right? And we're just very different sort of organizational structures, right? But that's not to say that we don't all work together on some level when it is useful. It's just for the types of work that some of the national organizations do, particularly those that are in D.C., like, it's a very specific type of advocacy that they're doing, and we plug in there when the stuff that we're doing aligns with that kind of advocacy, but we also do different types of advocacy and
right,
don't always need to be in D.C. Does that make sense, what I'm saying?
It does. You know, I'm in that really unique position and opportunity, I should say. I have this amazing opportunity to do this show, you know, for going on 7 years now and hear about such a wide range of issues, and I think only recently have I started ranking them, you know? And I think in some ways it's kind of natural to do that, and I would like to not subscribe to a hierarchy of issues, but at the same time, if I'm putting in front of me different plates of marriage equality and ENDA and blood donation and violence, I'm going to pick up the plates of blood donation and violence because those are the ones from which people are actually dying and where lives can be saved. And so it's tough just because I don't want to denigrate the work that people are doing on other issues. And I think we should be a multi-issue movement, and I think you are very right to question what is a movement and where are we.
Right.
Let's do that another episode.
Right.
And so sometimes I think it's also because you're on this week's episode, and so I look at some of the work other people are doing, and I'm thinking, oh, and we should fight for those things, but we also have to keep the other people alive, and that may trump things.
Right. I mean, and obviously I feel that way.
Right.
Right. I mean, I'm not sure that marriage would ever be my issue, right?
Right.
Like, I'm not sure that would ever be the thing that really got me, you know, excited about organizing or exciting about campaign work or, you know, but I think it is a piece of the puzzle, right?
Definitely.
Because ultimately what we're talking about, and it's not a piece of the puzzle that everybody wants to have, and that's fine. But if what we're talking about is treating LGBT people equally, respectfully, with dignity, with a sense of full small c citizenship in this country, right? Like, where we are all entitled to the same types of treatment, which is presumably respect and dignity, right?
Right.
Then we have to be talking about violence. We also have to be talking about immigration issues. We have to be talking about racism. We have to be talking about transphobia and homophobia. But we, you know, marriage matters. Employment non-discrimination matters. Civil rights generally matter, right? Like, there is too much work for us to do to think that none of it is important or that some of it is more important. But the reality is we find the things that speak to us. And what speaks to me is that violence, for me, is the ground floor of any sort of equality movement. Like, if you are not free to walk down the street and be who you are, then it doesn't really matter that you can get married. It doesn't really matter that you aren't going to be fired from your job. I mean, those things do matter, but not as that in that moment of urgency when you're walking down the street and your life is threatened, right?
Yeah.
And that's my perspective. But if we didn't have everybody doing everything, then we wouldn't be connecting the pieces. I think the real issue here is how well are we connecting the pieces,
right?
And how well are we working across issues to really see the intersections there? And, you know, honestly, I'm not sure that there isn't room for improvement there. And
right.
And I think that there's a lot more work that we can do to see those intersections and to really work, carefully on them.
I mean, what I hear you saying is that My Little Dog and Pony Radio Show is really the keystone that brings all of these organizations together.
That's actually what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I'm saying your radio show is the lens through which we should see fairness and equality for everyone. That's absolutely, I think you're absolutely right.
I just want to go pick up my Courage Award right now. All right. Well, speaking of major issues, let's turn our attention to you, my friend. Because you have had quite the year. Now, this is what happened. Now, this is if people had the director's cut of the last time you were on our show over a year ago, they would have heard that I started asking you this question, but then I was unintentionally outing you as having an impending pregnancy. And so we cut that part out because this is not the medium by which that news should be broken. That said,
we wanted to tell our moms first. Yeah.
I love the idea, though, and maybe we can work on this for next time, of instead of telling your moms, you know, over the phone or in person, you guys calling up and saying, hey, we would like you to listen to this podcast and then call us after. Love that idea.
Ken has something to tell you.
Yes. We have something to tell you, but through Ken. Okay.
Right.
Update us on the logistics. There was a birth, was there not?
There was, yes. So my wife and I have a baby. My wife did all the work. And Finch, our kid's name is Finch, is 8 months and some number of weeks that a good mother would know, but I do not. 8 months plus. And you know, our world is now a both dramatically different world and frankly less of a dramatically different world than I anticipated going into this whole adventure.
Well, I want to talk about logistically what you did, and I really don't want to gloss over this because I think it's pretty major. It is significant when an executive director of a major organization, and I think, let me just tip my hand right now and say, I think this was some of the most incredible role modeling you could have done for both other people in our field, other people doing social justice work, and certainly the people working for AVP. But you made this decision, and let everyone know if I'm mischaracterizing this, that you were taking a break from your work, and not only taking a break from your work, but you let people know, I'm focusing on my family right now, and the organization is going to be fine, and I'm coming back, but I swear to God, don't poke me on Facebook.
Yes. I actually did announce on Facebook, like, I'm not going to be on. I primarily use Facebook for, you know, pushing AVP stuff out and occasionally talking about my cats, as a good lesbian does every once in a while. But I did make sort of an announcement on Facebook that I was not going to be on Facebook as much during the time that I was on leave. And I think I pretty much stuck to that. Yeah.
Right. And it's hard to work through. I will say, and I do recall, I'm oversharing now, you know, years ago when I was going through a divorce, which is different than a birth, but when I said, you know what, I actually need to focus on other things than work right now, and so I need to leave my executive post for a couple months, I remember that initial feeling of, how could I possibly do that? And other people's reactions of, that can't possibly happen. But if you put in the work and you communicate, it actually can happen and it actually can work.
Yeah. And I mean, I will say, I think, you know, I am incredibly lucky at AVP because I have an amazing team of people. And in fact, as soon as we sort of understood the, oh, we're pregnant, and could do the math about, like, when is that going to happen,
right,
and how long is Sarah going to take off, and we always sort of understood that I was going to take some time off, Sarah and I, but very, very early on in the process, like a good almost year before I actually took the time off, I started to talk to my team about it and said, I really, really want to take 3 months off, and I want to get to know my kid, and I want to have a relationship with my kid, and I do not want to be a childcare provider for the rest of my life, like I will come back, I mean, I'll be a childcare provider on some level in the rest of my life, but not as my primary job function. You know, like, I will come back, but how are we going to do this? And my team being my management team, but also my board, they were just all so supportive of the concept, and that makes it easier. And they're all so skilled at what they do that we figured out pretty early on that they could probably do this. And it would be a stretch, and it would be hard, and it would mean bigger, you know, workloads for a short period of time. And we have the alternative of, like, let's bring somebody in to be an interim ED.
Right.
And they really didn't want that. They really wanted their leadership development. They really wanted to forward their goals. And I had such utter and complete faith and trust in their ability to do that that it made a lot of sense to say, okay, let's go. And I am not a person who can turn work off easily.
this is
true of all of the work that I've done in my life, not just AVP. And I am a very all or nothing person. So the last day before I went out on leave, I went out with my managers and we had a drink and we had a ceremonial deleting of my AVP email account from my phone.
Nice.
And I made a promise to them that I would not interfere. I mean, it became very, very clear to me very quickly that if I popped up once in a while, I would just be, first of all, the most annoying person on the planet, but second of all, so disruptive to their trajectory,
right?
And so that kept me going. But, you know, frankly, having a three-month-old who, you know, is relatively needy, right? My days were pretty full of pretty mundane stuff, but really important stuff to me. So there was also this other thing. You know, I think if I had gone on leave and was sitting on a beach somewhere, that would be awesome for the first 3 weeks, and then I would not have been able to keep my promise, right? But because I had this other human being to focus on, it was a little bit easier to keep my promise.
Yeah. I think it's huge.
They did a phenomenal job.
Yeah. No, I do want to add, because we talk about this in class all the time, of not just role modeling to other people in the field, but it's really important role modeling to women as well. Because in education, in social justice work, in nonprofit work, in corporate sectors, you know, all across, there are pretty strong instances of women feeling like they have to choose one or the other. And being able
to display
that, you know, you can advance in a field and you can hold your post and things will not fall apart and it doesn't reflect badly upon you, people need to see that. So I think it's huge what you've done. Now, I will close with you with the question that I was going to ask you last year before I knew I was outing this whole pregnancy thing. And I've been thinking a ton about this, and I would imagine you have as well. You've now brought a child into this world, and it's and you're still giggling about it, which I love.
It's still kind of cool, you know.
Oh yeah,
I suspect it will be for the next 40 or 60 years or so.
Well, and hopefully my question
until about 13 years from
now, and
it'll be less fun.
And my hope is my question doesn't take any of the shine off of that. But given the specific work that you do, you know, having this now additional role in your life of being a child care provider, you know, and ushering a life into this world that on the other side, you know, is filled with many incidences of violence, I would imagine that this changes your perspective slightly on the work that you do day in and day out.
You know, it's really interesting. I've actually thought about this a little bit. I love my child with all my heart. And so I say this with that context. Like, I don't actually think it does change my perspective because I think sometimes people think, and maybe for some people this is true, like, oh, you have a kid and then it hits so much harder and it hits home more. And I kind of feel like, no, I had this job and it hits pretty hard.
Yeah.
And now I have this kid and I kind of know what I'm looking out for, right? Like, I understand, like, we, you know, my wife and I had a million conversations about, like, gender identity and gender expression and, like, how do you raise a kid who can feel comfortable around their gender. And, you know, we talk about racism a lot and how do you teach kids not to be racist because kids are taught to be racist, right? And, like, how do you unteach that as they're being taught something else? And so it's a different lens, right? Like, I haven't thought about, you know, the fact that the songs that I sing to my four-month-old or my five-month-old or my six-month-old are very deliberate and nursery rhymes are terribly violent and we don't have those kinds of things in our house. And we don't watch TV as much anymore. And we don't, you know, there's lots of ways in which, like, having a kid has impacted my life. But in terms of making my job more sort of real or more personal, like, I'm not sure that could have happened anyways. My job was pretty real and pretty personal before I had this kid, right? Sometimes I wonder, because I say things that make me sound like a terrible, terrible parent. Like I say things like, you know, kids are really hard. And like when people say, how was leave? I say, oh, it's fantastic, but I was so happy to get back to work. And I say things like, I'm a terrible child care provider, right? Like I think I'm old enough not to be embarrassed about the things that are really real to me, and I assume that other people are going through them, and if it's not the right thing to say, that they'll correct me, you know. But this kid matters so much to me,
yeah.
And I and my family matters so much to me, and my, you know, those relationships are so critical. But there's also, like, that's complementary to the work that I'm doing, right? Like,
right.
I'm doing this work to make, you know, I am invested in the fact that I am safe, my family is safe, my community is safe, this, you know, people in this country are safe, and this is just an extension of that. It's not a shift from it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Oh, it does. Oh, so well said. So well said. Well, you have to know you're one of my favorite people out there. I'm so happy we had this opportunity to do an extended chat, because I was reading through the report and I think you just do so well, you and everybody else there at AVP and all this coalition of organizations across the country do so well at not getting overwhelmed. And I'm sure you still have those moments of like, oh my God, it's another incident, or let's look at this culmination of incidents and look at these stats and they're maybe not going in the right direction. But then you take that as fuel. It's so clear watching you all do this. You take that as fuel and turn it into action. And it's incredible to behold. I have to tell you, as I always say, you know, I'm looking at your website right now. I wish I was a full-time paralegal, because that's the only employment opportunity open right now.
But we do have that opportunity open.
All right. So for somebody else, I would switch. I would do a career change. But yeah, no, please, to everyone there at AVP, there's no way. You're so great at making it clear that you're not a one-woman show, that there's all these different folks doing this work. And yet at the
Absolutely.
Same time, I have to tell you, I feel so much safer and so much more confident in this work, knowing that you are helming so many of these efforts.
Oh,
so I love having you on.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you. Well, I love being on the show. It is the most fun that I ever have talking about my job.
Yay.
I really appreciate it. Now, next time, we're going to talk about your personal life.
Yeah, good luck with that. All right, so this, for our listening audience, is Sharon's fifth and final time on this show. It's So Gay.
It's so mean.
Everybody,
please.
This show
is so mean.
This show is so mean. It's just so mean. Everybody should stroll on over to avp.org. At the very, very least, my friends, please educate yourself on what's going on there. But the great thing about avp.org is it gives you different directions that you can head when you take that information and turn it into action, because in all of our communities, we need more action. Sharon, thank you for doing what you do.
Thank you so much, Ken. It was such a pleasure.
All right, everybody. Come on, people now.
Feel good. Peace.
All right, folks, that about wraps things up for this week's episode. There was a ton of news out there. We don't really have time to get to it. Very briefly, a federal appeals court panel ruled this week they upheld a lower court ruling that Virginia's ban on same-sex marriage is unconstitutional. Judge Henry Floyd wrote in his decision, quote, inertia and apprehension, I love this quote, inertia and apprehension are not legitimate basis for denying same-sex couples due process and equal protection of the laws. So things are moving ahead in Virginia. And quick update down in Florida, a Florida judge with jurisdiction over Miami-Dade County just last week struck down the state's marriage equality ban, noting in her decision that the law offends, quote, basic human dignity. Another judge issued a similar ruling earlier this month for Monroe County. And as we've said with all of these, the Miami-Dade ruling was stayed pending appeal and is likely to reach the state Supreme Court. That's what happens with these decisions. They do not immediately go into effect. It does not mean everyone can run and get married because they want to give people a chance to appeal, because these appeals are quite likely. In fact, they're pretty much guaranteed. And that's it. Our huge thanks to Sharon Staple. My gosh, in the history of doing this show and so many hundreds of episodes, it's just such a pleasure to be able to take the time and do an extended chat on such an important issue, and an issue that overwhelms, I know, so many of us. And we look at violence in the news and think, well, there's nothing we can do. And I think that if you can work through that, if you can get past that initial overwhelming feeling and see, yes, there are conversations that you can start and there are inequalities that you can address that will directly lead to a decrease in violence in our communities, if you can get past that overwhelming feeling, there's such a difference you can make. And there are tools out there to help you in doing that. So stroll on over to avp.org and learn more about what it is that you can do, because we all have a part in it and we can't turn a blind eye to it. You know, we can say, hey, marriage equality is not my issue, or ENDA is not my issue, or blood donation is not my issue. But when our brothers and sisters are losing their lives, I mean, they're actually losing their lives. It's not a metaphor. It's not hyperbole. They're actually being killed, being murdered, being victims of violence. That affects all of us. And so we all play a part in that. We all must do more. AVP.org. Super fun show for you coming at you next week with Erin Foley. Comic Erin Foley's coming back to the show because she's coming back to Cleveland, and she's doing some fun stuff here in celebration of the Gay Games coming up in just a couple weeks here in Cleveland. So she'll be on next week's show. As always, if you guys have any guest ideas, just send them to me. Ken@thisshowisogay.com. Whoever you can think of, send them to me and we'll try to get them on the show. It is that easy. In the meantime, get out there, my friends. Go do whatever it is that you do to make a difference in this world. Use your voice the way you know how to use it and it's distinctive to you, to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And while you are out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?
Skies are blue and fields of green, water full of atrazine, 100 acres to explore, acres full of alichlor. Hey, hey, ho, ho, Mom and Dad, how could they know? Ho, ho, hey, hey, herbicides done made me gay. When I was a tiny tot, 2,4-D in Paraguay, beneath my prairie home, fractured my X chromosome. Hey, hey, my, my, all these years I wondered why. My, my, hey, hey, herbicides done made me gay. Endless hours of glee. Hey, hey, dang, dang, sing along with Katie Lang. Dang, dang, hey, hey, herbicides done made me gay.